What will investors call these last few days? Black Thursday, Stormy November, Wacky Wednesday?
It's not the 4th of July, it's not Thanksgiving, it's not even Christmas. It's better than all those. It's Crazy Eddie Day. You'll save money like never before during Crazy Eddie's Crazy Eddie Day sale.
Yes, with prices this low on Wall Street, you'd have to be crazy not to buy. Bottom feeding. It's a sale of the century, taking stock of stock on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, November 21st. And John, I didn't think I would ever hear bye on The Takeaway.
Crazy Eddie's back. Good morning, Adora.
Today, we're going to talk about the markets and oil. We also have Michael Moore. Thoughts on the state of the auto industry and our last installment on the Takeaway's debt series. That and more, but first headlines.
Right, we'll tell you how it turns out. You're not out of debt yet. Stocks regained significant ground in Asia today. It appears Wall Street will open higher after 2 days of heavy losses around the globe. European markets are mostly flat after early gains. Congress heads off for a two-week break, and for now it's still a big N-O for Detroit automakers. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the industry must demonstrate it has some plan for a $25 billion infusion.
It is essential that we see some restructuring, some path to viability from the industry.
Congress will come back and pick up the debate on December 8th.
President Bush was up early this morning and he has signed a bill to extend unemployment benefits. Jobless claims are at a 16-year high. Attorney General Michael Mukasey collapsed last night in the middle of a speech. No word on the cause. He spent the night in the hospital and is said to be alert and talking.
A federal judge has ruled that the U.S. government has no basis for holding five Algerians at Guantanamo Bay. Constitutional law expert Jonathan Turley says the decision, which some see as a blow to the Bush administration, was completely predictable.
Guantanamo Bay was created for one purpose and one purpose only, to avoid legal process. Once the legal process began, it's inevitable that many of these detainees will be released.
The five Algerians have maintained all along they're not terrorists. Alaska Senator Ted Stevens yielded the floor for the last time yesterday.
My motto has been here, to hell with politics. Just do what's right for Alaska. And I've tried every day to live up to those words.
The longest-running senator was convicted last month on federal corruption charges. In other signs of change on Capitol Hill, Henry Waxman, Democrat of California, will take over the House Energy and Commerce Committee from Michigan's John Dingell. Dingell held the position for 28 years. It's a sign that Barack Obama's footprints are all over this new Congress. Oil's up around $50 a barrel again after sinking to $48 a barrel yesterday. We are talking about crashing markets here at The Takeaway and the debt problem. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or my take at thetakeaway.org. What's your story?
I got into debt and I had to sell all my possessions, including my house. And I'm not in debt anymore, but I live very simply.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You know, each one of these stories is fascinating.
Oh, absolutely.
And you can really empathize with these people. We're also on our website talking about debt strategies, debt reduction strategies with Alvin Hall. He's going to be answering your questions about getting out of debt. Come on, folks. Try to stump Alvin Hall and let's work together. We can solve this.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Anyway, you slice it, markets were crashing for the last 2 days all around the world, on Wall Street, in Asia, in Europe. Markets really reached something of a bottom yesterday. The question is, will that continue? In Asian stock markets, there's been a bit of a recovery this morning after opening sharply down following the U.S. markets. In Europe, the FTSE index in London is up more than 0.5%. It's basically flat over in Europe. Frankfurt and Paris are marginally in positive territory. Oil, while being under $50 a barrel in the New York Merc yesterday, closed above 50. But Brent crude and other oil prices are fluctuating down there below $50. There's a crash in the oil markets along with other commodities. Joining us to discuss all of these deep trends in the midst of what looks like a fairly substantial capitulation this week is Michael Hunter, markets correspondent for the Financial Times, coming to us from London. Michael, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, John.
And Lisa Marganelli, fellow at the New American Foundation, author of Oil on the Brain. She joined us from Oakland, California. Lisa, thanks for being here.
Hello.
Lisa, I wonder if you'd elaborate something for me on the oil markets, just for people to understand what's going on. The New York Merc reports a price of $50 a barrel, but Brent crude is well under 50. And there are other markets where people buy oil, actual oil buyers, not speculators and commodities traders, where oil is trading lower. I've even seen quotes as low as $40 a barrel. Can you take these apart for us?
Well, people are trading partly they're actually trading on the actual – some oils are sold in discount to others. So the places that people are selling the oil for $40 a barrel, it's usually oil that has more sulfur in it or is thicker or something like that. The New York market tends to be the most expensive, partly because the wealthiest consumers are here, but partly because they're trading a very – one very scarce kind of crude oil, which is WTI or West Texas Intermediate. So that usually trades at a more expensive price than others. It's very light, very easy to refine.
So $50 a barrel at this point is the ceiling, not the floor of the price at this point.
Exactly.
We're going to come back and talk about that in a moment. Michael Hunter, what's happening in Europe this morning? And if we could talk a little bit about the pressure on Citigroup, which yesterday fell below $5 a share and looks like it might actually be putting itself up for sale in some of its sector businesses.
I think, John, the alarm bells are still ringing on European equities markets. We're seeing support kicking in for the FTSE 100. Every time it falls around about 3,800 to a reading of 3,800 points, it starts to receive a little bit of a bounce and moves towards 4,000 again. There's a kind of technical level of resistance at 3,800. But in terms of the mood out there, it's still one of great caution, largely because people are a little bit worried about what the underlying health of Citigroup might actually be like. And until we get a bit more direction on that, I think we'll see this caution hanging around and these gains that we've been talking about this morning won't rise too much further from the kind of levels we're looking at now.
Is the confidence problem with Citigroup something to do with what they're not telling us, or is there just a fundamental lack of faith in a financial institution of the size of Citigroup?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. I think we would have liked to have seen a little bit more meat in some statements coming out from Citigroup, a little bit more of a clear sense of direction in terms of what they're going to do, whether or not they need to raise as much capital as some people are saying they're going to need to raise. But do remember also, John, that these fears are still rumours. We don't know exactly whether or not Citigroup is undercapitalised. The rumours are such that there are concerns that they might not be able to take many more big hits from subprime or from asset write-downs relating to that or indeed anything else. We're not entirely sure yet exactly whether or not they are actually in trouble. It's just a fear that they might well be in the near future.
And Lisa, given the economic slowdown and all of this uncertainty in all of the world markets, clearly, OPEC cannot be pleased that the oil prices have gone down as low as they have. They've called another emergency meeting. What options do they really have at this point?
Well, they can cut their production. But one thing that happens when OPEC cuts its production is that if, you know, all of their member states are watching their income shrink dramatically. And what happens when OPEC cuts production is that people start furiously trading on the side. They exceed their quotas on the side. And then that can actually drive prices down more because you have this sort of sloshy little pool of unofficial oil going out at the same time that you've got the more official stuff. So they really need to, if they're going to make a cut, which they're probably going to say they're going to make a cut, then they need to go out there and get everybody on board to actually make that cut, and that's going to be rough. And they also have—they just have a lot of pressure from their member states. You know, everybody from Hugo Chavez to Sarah Palin is watching their income of their state shrink dramatically.
And you know how those guys hang around together a lot.
I think they pal around a lot.
There. Yeah, they're real pals.
That's a joke.
But the flip side of this, Lisa, though, is, of course, that I just saw the national average for a gallon of gas in the U.S. is $1.99. So for consumers, there are lots of people who are jumping for joy at these prices, but there's a whole lot more for them to consider, right, because it could come back to bite us.
Well, it will come back to bite us, I think. The other thing is that people are not exactly jumping for joy about the prices. I just saw that in September of this year, we drove 10.7 billion miles less than September of last year. So prices may be coming down, but I think people are sort of sitting on the front step and looking at the car rather than driving it. So that's kind of, that would be the first bummer. I think the second bummer is that what happens when oil prices fall is that oil producing countries stop drilling holes in the ground to keep their production up. And that means that their production starts to fall, and which makes a lot of sense. Nobody wants to be throwing money into the ground when the oil coming out of it isn't worth anything. But what that means is that when the economy does recover and starts to tick up, we're going to hit very quickly kind of a limit on oil production, and prices are going to go up very high again.
Well, Michael Hunter, do we have any indication that in emerging markets that, as Lisa suggests, are really sort of strapped, that they've committed themselves to this high oil revenue, both in terms of price and in terms of production, any indication that countries like Venezuela, Mexico are beginning to default on some of their obligations, and so the oil price crash has a sort of an ancillary effect on the financial markets?
Not yet, not in terms of emerging markets, which are getting a shoeing, by the way, John, at the moment, largely because investors are moving money away from anything that's even vaguely risky into government debt and other safer investment instruments, including gold, which is, of course, doing very well at the moment. It's too early to say yet whether this oil price has a read across into the national balance sheets of those kind of countries. The more sensible ones have kept enough in reserve down the years to be able to weather storms like this. And don't forget, as recently as this summer, we were seeing oil knocking on the door of $150, which has given people a little bit of wriggle room. And there are people out there who are telling us, albeit off the record at the moment, that they can't really see this kind of weakness in oil prices being sustained in the medium or long term.
So we will pause at $40 or $50 a barrel and then move to some sort of price stable rate that may be in the 80s or 90s, something like that?
Well, again, I mean, it would be a braver man than I to actually put a number on it. And many people were putting 40 in play, you know, even in research notes we've been looking at today.
I mean, not brave, Michael, just an idiot. That's me. That's all I need to do. Back to Citigroup for just a minute. You want to venture a guess? You won't guess on the price of oil, so you're not brave. But what about Vikram Pandit at Citicorp? Does he stay or go?
Well, again, I think Mr. Pandit's under quite a lot of pressure. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But I think, again, you'd need a very, very brave man to want to step into his shoes. And quite often in the upper echelons of the corporate world, this amount of danger can actually help protect somebody in terms of their succession. I can't imagine anybody being keen to take over his job at the helm of that company right now.
The New York Times suggests that $8.3 trillion has vanished from world markets in the combined decline of stock markets over the last 13 months and a decline in mutual funds that trade in commodities. Where does that $8.3 trillion go?
Well, a lot of it's gone into gold. Some of it's kind of gone up in smoke with the assumption that the world economy allowed itself to make that U.S. house prices would carry on rising forever. So a lot of it is accounted for in that way.
We'll be feeling that pain, the next several years, maybe a decade. Lisa Marganelli, quickly before we go, you mentioned two bummers. Any other bummers from out there in the Bay Area? No. All right, I'll give you a break on that since we got to go. But, they know about bummers out in Oakland, California. Michael Hunter, markets correspondent for the Financial Times, thanks for joining us. Lisa Marganelli, of course, a fellow at the New America Foundation, our friend and author of the book Oil on the Brain. Thanks, guys.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. When the banking industry went to Capitol Hill, it got billions in bailout money. This week, when the automakers went to the Hill, they wanted the same boost and got nothing in return, though lawmakers may take up the issues again next month. For now, many predict millions of jobs are at risk while the auto industry is in a major slump. Filmmaker Michael Moore says Washington is applying an unacceptable double standard. A Flint native, his 1989 documentary, Roger and Me, discussed many of the issues plaguing the industry today. We spoke to him about the developments this week. Michael Moore, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So what have you been thinking as you're watching the back and forth between, or among, I should say, the car makers, the heads of those companies, and the lawmakers in Capitol Hill?
Well, of course, the first thing I've noticed comparing what's been going on this week with the automaker executives there, and a few weeks ago when all the big bankers and insurance company people were there, is that when the banks and Wall Street showed up, it was, welcome. What can we do for you? Just step right up here to our ATM machine. Whatever you need. No questions asked. And these people on Wall Street, they actually don't make anything. they just make money off money, you know, or as we've learned, off in invisible magical schemes that don't exist in the three-dimensional reality that we all live in. But the automakers actually produce something. They produce something that's useful that people need to use in our society. And as soon as they arrived, it's like, oh, wait a minute here. I don't know. This just doesn't sound like a good idea. I immediately noticed the difference in between how the Wall Street bankers were treated and these poor schmucks from Detroit.
But even you are well aware of the conundrum here. I mean, here you were way ahead of the curve 20 years ago when you made the documentary Roger and Me and just identified some of the real problems of the direction that the auto industry was heading in.
Right. Now, well, yes. And I've for 20 years have tried to, you know, tell people, whoever would listen, that these companies are not going to survive. They don't have the best interests of the country or their workers at heart.
Mm-hmm.
And unless we do something about this, there's going to be a total collapse. The collapse now is here. And what needs to happen is, you know, we the people and our representatives in Congress have almost a moral responsibility to protect the industrial infrastructure that these companies represent. This large, vast industrial infrastructure in this country must not be allowed to just vanish, or we are all going to suffer. Not just the few million workers that are going to hurt as a result of this, but the entire society will have a very hard time recovering from something that could trigger a real depression. Having said that, just giving a bailout to the current management, to the people that have been running this company and who've run it into the ground, or these companies, is just an absolute mistake. And I think Congress and our new president needs to do what Franklin Roosevelt did at the beginning of World War II, where he said to General Motors and Ford and Chrysler, I'm sorry, you're not going to build cars anymore. You're going to build planes and tanks and other things that we need because we are facing an enormous crisis. Well, we're facing an enormous crisis right now with the economy, with the polar ice caps melting, which are in large part due to the automobiles on this planet, and to the fact that we are running out of oil. We have very little on this continent, and sometime within our lifetime or our children or grandchildren's lifetime, we're not going to have this fossil fuel. So Detroit has done nothing to prepare for those calamities that are ahead of us.
But that's the conundrum right there, though, isn't it? In other words, management has not thought about the future. They were busy making those big gas-guzzling SUVs that it turns out are not as energy efficient and not sustainable when gases are as high as we saw over the summertime. At the same token, you don't want to punish the workers for the mistake of management. So how do you balance those two things?
The government says we're going to provide the money to keep these factories open. We are removing the management because now we, the people, are investing billions of dollars into the company. We actually are now going to become the de facto owners of the companies, and we are going to determine what these companies are going to build. So remove the management of these corporations and put in their place people who are charged with the responsibility to build hybrid cars, fuel-efficient cars, and mass transit, especially mass transit. Imagine if all of our car factories were suddenly building light rail, locomotives, trains, buses, inner-city buses, things that we, you know, true mass transit, subways. If we had a national public works program using our factories to build these things that the society needs and the planet needs in order to prevent the environmental collapse that's coming, if we did that, everyone wins. The workers have good jobs. The planet cleans itself up, and the economy starts to recover.
But do we really want the government in the business of making anything?
No. Yes and no. No. The government should not be the automaker. The government should not be building cars. But the government can control who's building the cars and how they're being built and the kinds of cars or vehicles or mass transit that's being built. That's what we have to do. And that's a simple thing. Roosevelt did it, and Barack Obama needs to do it when he takes office.
Last question. We're doing a series this week on debt. What are your tricks for staying out of debt?
Well, I'll tell you what I've always done. I didn't own my first credit card until I was 35 years old. I just, all through my 20s, I just thought, you know, I saw my friends go into, you know, horrible debt as young people, overusing their credit cards. So I never used a credit card. I waited until I had cash to buy a car. And that's how I've always, you know, lived my life. I've just never really believed that debt was a good idea. I also have never bought for myself a share of stock because I've always believed that I should make my money from my labor and my creativity.
No credit cards and no stocks. You know what, Michael Moore? I think there's a whole lot of people out there who are going to wish they didn't have a credit card and they never bought stock. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Filmmaker Michael Moore, his most recent movie is Sicko, a documentary comparing the American healthcare industry to other nations. Now we turn to Mark Garrison, who's got the headlines of the morning.
Thank you. We're headed towards 29 minutes after the hour. A federal judge ordered the release yesterday of five Algerian men held at Guantanamo Bay. The judge said there isn't enough evidence to keep them. The men were part of a group of inmates who won a Supreme Court case. The court ruled they had a right to seek release in federal court. Attorney General Michael Mukasey collapsed while giving a speech in Washington last night. The Justice Department said the 67-year-old cabinet member was conscious and alert, this after being admitted to George Washington University Hospital. The president spoke to him this morning. The White House says he sounded well. The May earthquake in China's Sichuan province left more than 88,000 people dead or missing. Today, China announced that more than 19,000 of them were school children.
Wow.
That's well above previous estimates, and many poorly built schools were destroyed during the 7.9 quake there.
Oh, it's a horrible tragedy. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. All week we've been asking and pleading for your advice on debt.
I'm listening to your series on Better Nation. I have my own new plan. I'm going to take my kids over to Nebraska and leave them, and then I'm going to pick them up in about 7 years, and they can both start getting jobs. I can save money and generate income for the country as well.
He's referring to the story that we did about Safe Haven Law there in Nebraska, where people are dropping off their children and abandoning them.
Not for thrift reasons, although he came up with that on his own. I thought that was
interesting. Anyhow, we do want your thoughts and ideas on debt and how to deal with it. 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
So let's take a close look at the labor market. The 16-year high is what the new claims for unemployment were when they were announced by the Labor Department this week. Well over 500,000 people newly claimed unemployment. And there have been layoff announcements all week long, 52,000 at Citigroup, another 1,000 or so at Washington Mutual. Fidelity is cutting 1,700 jobs. Sun Microsystems is going to lay off 18% of its workforce. What we want to do now is get a sense of the food chain in the labor market. How interrelated are all these job classifications? Joining us is Gus Fauché, Director of Macroeconomics for Moody'sEconomy.com. He joins us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Gus, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, the auto industry executives who spoke on Capitol Hill today would have us believe that roughly 200,000 workers in the Detroit auto industry represent maybe 1.2 million workers who are include the suppliers, but then the entire sort of ripple effect of them all losing their jobs raises it to maybe 2 million or even by some estimates, 3 million. Looking at the job losses that have been announced already in the financial sector, the Citigroup number, what is the ripple effect of these jobs?
Well, it's pretty high, and particularly because in the financial sector, a lot of those jobs are very well paying. So we're going to see, you know, people who in consumer services who supply those folks, you know, they're going to lose their jobs as well. So we think by the time all of it's said and done, we'll probably see job losses of somewhere 2.5 million, and that is if none of the big three go bankrupt. If one of them or more does, we're going to see even more job losses.
So 2.5 million, even if the auto industry stays at the same level of employment, if it survives.
Yes, correct.
All right, let's talk about the sectors where these unemployment announcements and layoff announcements are really hurting the hardest. I mean, you mentioned the financial sector. Is there something about the kinds of people being laid off during this recession that's different from what you've seen in the past?
Well, I mean, certainly this recession started in the housing market. So we first started to see job losses in construction and then industries that are tied to the housing market. So, you know, your home improvement superstores, your building material suppliers, that kind of thing. But now we're seeing much more widespread job losses. We're seeing it throughout manufacturing. We're seeing it especially in financial services. But we'll see more and more job losses just in regular consumer services, in business and professional services that help the financial services industry. And I think by the time we're all said and done, there are going to be job losses throughout the economy.
Now, let's go back to the financial services sector for a moment. You said that the ripple effect of these high-paying people losing their jobs at Citigroup and Fidelity, et cetera, means that landscape contractors, waitresses, waiters, restaurant workers, service workers who supply the personnel at Wall Street are also going to be losing their jobs. We haven't even seen that spike yet, it sounds like you're saying.
Yeah, and I mean, those job losses are going to be kind of gradual. It's not going to be the big layoff announcements. You're just going to see fewer people being hired. When people quit, nobody's going to replace them. So it's not like you're going to see big announcements in those sectors, but you are going to see over time and a gradual erosion of employment, you know, probably for another year or so.
There was significant unemployment increases in the 1980s recession, where the economy seemed to go through some sort of a structural change and became much more of a service economy on the other side of it. How does what's going on right now stack up to what went on in the 80s?
Well, certainly so far this isn't as bad as it was in the 1980s, and I don't expect that it's going to be that bad. Back then we had double-digit inflation, and the Federal Reserve moved interest rates up to 20% in order to choke off inflation. That led to a huge correction in the housing market. We saw an enormous restructuring in the auto industry. The unemployment rate then almost got to 11%. I don't think it's going to get anywhere close to that this time, although it's still going to be probably the highest since that period.
What's helping to keep it from being that severe? You mentioned interest rates.
Well, certainly certainly the Federal Reserve is keeping interest rates low, but I think our economy is structurally stronger than it was back then. It's pretty flexible now, so that if people do get laid off, there are opportunities in other sectors. And I think we're also having much more responsive fiscal policy. So the government is out there spending. We're going to see a big fiscal stimulus package probably as soon as President Obama is sworn in, you know, maybe in the order of a $300 billion or so. So we would expect to see a lot of government spending to help support employment, too.
All right, well, let's end on the stimulus package then. If we consider what you've talked about in terms of the sectors that have been affected and how this is beginning to generalize, if we can think of that as an MRI of the labor force, where should the stimulus package be targeted to have the best impact?
Well, I think there are three areas where it should be targeted. First is getting money to people who are kind of on the edge. These are folks who, if they get money, they're going to go out and spend it. So that's things like extended unemployment insurance benefits or expanded food stamps. Second factor would be aid to state and local governments. If state and local governments get the money, they'll spend it almost immediately. And then also infrastructure spending. State and local governments have a lot of infrastructure projects lined up. They can spend it almost immediately on roads, that kind of thing. And that would get the money out into the economy quickly, creating new jobs.
All right. Gus Fauché, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Gus Fauché is the director of macroeconomics for MoodysEconomy.com. Thank you, Gus. And now Mark Garrison has the headlines.
Thank you. It's 21 minutes before the hour. The lower house of Russia's parliament, the State Duma, voted to pass a bill that would extend the presidential term from 4 years to six. Now it goes to the upper house, where approval is expected quickly. The measure is viewed as a signal that Vladimir Putin wants to retake the presidency. Peacekeepers in eastern Congo will have reinforcements within weeks. The UN made the announcement today. The 17,000 soldiers there now are having trouble providing aid while fighting between rebel forces and government troops continues. Thousands of protesters gathered in Baghdad for a mass prayer called by Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. They're protesting a proposed Iraqi security pact that would allow U.S. troops to stay in the country until 2011. The Iraqi parliament is set to vote on the pact Monday. A bomb exploded at the funeral of Shiite cleric in northwest Pakistan, killing at least six. The cleric had been killed last Friday by gunmen. Shiites are a minority in mostly Sunni Muslim Pakistan. Wall Street's looking at better days after yesterday's beating. Dow futures are up about 2.5%. That's despite news of more financial troubles for banks. Just yesterday, Washington Mutual announced that they'll cut 1,600 jobs. Now, we talk about financial news. We had a lot of grim news out of Iceland. You have
a
collapse
of
their banking system, currency. Right. You know, it's first major Western nation to get help from the IMF. So we wanted to, like, bring something different from Iceland. So today happens to be Bjork's birthday. So,
whose birthday?
Bjork.
Bjork.
Mm-hmm. So we pulled something from when she was in her first band, the Sugar Cubes, and they were, it was a little obvious to choose a song called Birthday, but it's a good song. So to make up for it, we found a version with kind of a spooky production that we can listen to a little bit as we celebrate.
Icelanders rallying around Bjork. In the midst of their financial troubles.
That's what we got.
Emotional story from Mark Garrison. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adoree Udoji. And John, from all the signs, at least the ones we can tell, Arizona's governor looks high on the list to head the Department of Homeland Security in the Barack Obama administration. Janet Napolitano is a former U.S. attorney, an early Obama supporter, and as a border governor, she's fought to curb illegal immigration. She's also dealt with flooding and wildfire issues and FEMA, which, of course, is part of the Homeland Security Department. Michael Greenberger is the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. And this is an agency that is just 6 years old. What would Napolitano potentially inherit?
Well, she'll inherit an agency that really has never gotten on its feet. As you may know, it's a conjunction of 22 different federal agencies. Early in the so-called war on terror, the thought was that all the agencies that had a responsibility for it should be brought under one roof. And as you mentioned, included in that is the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which also makes it responsible for dealing with incidents of national significance in terms of natural events as well as man-made terror attacks.
What do you think that the Arizona governor would bring to the job?
Well, the most important thing she can bring to the job is the agency has never been properly administered. It's obviously a terrific challenge bringing 22 different agencies together and making them function smoothly. She has a reputation of being a very strong executive, and the agency is in desperate need of a strong executive. Secondly, she has a reputation of being able to attract top talent to work with her in her various projects. And this agency is so huge that she can't run it by herself. And I expect that if she is the nominee, she'll be able to bring in people who can run the various parts of it, and she can delegate responsibility down the line in an effective fashion.
What do you think is key for whoever gets this job, and are there other people that come to mind?
Well, again, I go back to the idea people are very focused on Homeland Security and looking for someone who has expertise in that area. I certainly think she does. You mentioned border control. It has a lot of law enforcement responsibilities. And she certainly, as a former state attorney general and U.S. attorney, is law enforcement experience. And also, one of the great problems with the department is it's never really meshed well with state and local first responders. They're the front line of battles for either natural disasters or terrorist attacks, and she'll bring a lot to that. But doubtless, the most important thing is she's a very effective executive. She's been well recognized as a very talented governor, and I think she brings first and foremost that responsibility. In terms of other names, I think someone who, at least in my experience, I would have placed very high on this list is a woman named Jamie Gorelick, who had served as deputy attorney general in the Clinton administration for many years.
Right, and so we'll see. We'll see. There's certainly been lots of talk in the papers and on the news. Michael Greenberger, director of Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, thank you.
You're welcome.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, November 21st. Mark Garrison is with us with the headlines.
Thank you. We're coming up at 12 minutes before the hour. And share prices on Asian stock markets recovered after yesterday's plunge on Wall Street. European markets are mixed. Dow futures show a positive opening. Citigroup's board is meeting today. Members will talk about restoring investor confidence. Citigroup's stock has taken a beating this week. It's at a 15-year low. And also some news from Walmart, the giant retailer. Lee Scott is stepping down as CEO. Mike Duke, who is coming in as CEO. He's from within the company. Attorney General Michael Mukasey is still in the hospital but conscious and alert after collapsing during a speech last night. The Justice Department would not comment when asked if Mukasey suffered a stroke. Give us a workable plan and we could give you the money you want next month. That's the message from congressional Democrats to Detroit's big three automakers. A possible compromise might lie in reallocating a $25 billion earmark to develop more fuel-efficient cars. The race is tightening in the recount for the Minnesota Senate seat. Republican incumbent Norm Coleman's lead over Democratic Al Franken has slipped a bit to just over 100 votes. The recount started this week. Could go on for some time.
It's a cliffhanger.
Yeah. You also see some cool features in the public radio world. Minnesota Public Radio has a great feature where they've put images of some of the actual challenge ballots on the air, so you kind of get to be your own election office official.
Well, they have
decide
names.
To take them or not.
They have to names for them, like the Hanging Chads in Florida. There's the arrow. There's the
X,
thumbprint.
The
X. It's interesting. It's good stuff.
And boy, is it a close one considering a race where nearly
3 million
votes were cast. Thanks very much, Mark. Alvin Hall is now going to join us to wrap up our series on debt. Alvin is a financial educator and author of You and Your Money, Mastering the Emotions Behind the Numbers. Welcome, Alvin. It's always a pleasure to have you.
I'm glad to be back.
So we've been asking our listeners, as we've been talking about debt this week, all week, every slice of debt, whether it's individual, company, or government debt. Mm-hmm. And specifically, we've been asking them now to ask you questions about how to deal with debt, and we have a question.
Yeah.
Matthew Stover calling from Philadelphia, passing through New York. I like the show. Please explain more about the Federal Reserve system. Please explain how fiat money is printed out of thin air.
So Federal Reserve money, how do you break that down?
The government decides through a series of meetings how much money it needs to inject in the economy in order to encourage banks to lend or to restrict that money by essentially buying money back or pulling money out of the economy through various means.
And it is literally a printing decision.
It literally is a printing decision, how much money we need to inject into the banks just to get money flowing through the economy. And this is one of those things that's often referred to as the velocity of money, the speed with which when I pay you, if I were your employer, Adora, and you got that money, how long would it be before you spent it at a shop that was owned by John? John paid it to his employees, and they want to see how quickly the money is moving through the economy, and they print money in order to encourage that, or they decrease the printing of money in order to discourage it.
So why not, if there's a credit squeeze on, just inject money? But essentially that is...
Well, if they inject money,
the bailout plan is to inject money into the system, but it doesn't seem to be loosening up that much.
No, everyone who is loaning money today is terribly afraid that the entity, be it an individual or a bank or a big corporation to whom they would lend the money, would all of a sudden go bankrupt, and then they would not be able to get that money back because most of these are unsecured loans. They're backed by nothing more than good faith and your promise to pay.
Speaking of unsecured loans, let's talk about credit cards.
Yes.
Target.
Target is having one of the worst years with its credit business. Many of the companies sell on their credit card portfolios to banks, and banks take on the risk. But Target and Nordstrom's decided to keep those businesses. And Target has seen over the past couple of years that its delinquency rate has gone up. Just this last month, the delinquency rate went up to around 8.1%, which is part of the national average. But even worse for them, the number of charge-offs, the number of credit card holders that they've decided to just walk away from and not collect, is up to 10.2%. That is a substantial number.
And clearly, they're not alone. This is spread across all of the credit card companies, and obviously a sign that people are struggling in paying their bills.
Yes, it is. You find that general purpose credit cards like Visa and MasterCards, their charge-offs are now 6.8%. 6.08%, up 1.7% from a year ago. And specific retail cards are up to 8.1%. So everybody is struggling. I think these credit card companies, these retail companies, had used credit cards as a way to boost their returns.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, it seems like there's something wrong with the entire business model there. If you build in that much in terms of the default and the fraud, we haven't even talked about fraud
yes.
in credit cards, and then charge a giant interest rate to cover the defaults and frauds.
Right.
You're basically in a situation where somebody's going to run into trouble somewhere. It'd be much better to have a lower interest rate and a much more rational relationship between the store and the consumer rather than some abstract kind of credit card instrument.
I agree, but when you see these store cards charging 20%, the business model shifts automatically in their mind. They begin to see the credit card business as equal to, and in some cases, better than the actual retail sales business. A friend of mine who owns a jewelry store in Cincinnati told me the story of how his father used to sell necklaces and rings, and one day he started offering credit terms, and the amount of money they were earning just on the interest equal the amount that they were earning by selling the jewelry in the store.
But to this point, we spoke to Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard this week, and she said on the consumer side, you need to be watching diligently because in these volatile times, the credit card companies have so much power that they can just change the terms of your card, add fees, change your interest rate, and you may not even be aware of it.
Absolutely. A good friend of mine in Greenwich, Connecticut, who pays his credit cards every month, found that his grace period had been reduced to 15 days.
And they can do that arbitrarily.
Arbitrarily. And he had paid every credit card on time for every single month he had had the credit card.
So what's your advice to consumers then, given this environment?
I think you need to reduce your dependency on credit cards and shop around for the best one. But understand that what you have today may not be the same credit card you have tomorrow.
Because the whole fee structure of the credit card business is a kind of an unregulated environment in banking. And the other thing that's really fascinating about what you say is that companies like General Electric make the same mistake as your jewelry friend.
Exactly.
They tried to make all their money on financing, on the cash and the money that they had, and they ran into trouble. And their locomotive business, their jet engine business, can't save them any more than the jewelry could save your friend.
Absolutely.
Fascinating stuff, Alvin.
And clearly something to be watching, because the credit card companies are taking a big hit in their revenue, as you pointed out in your jewelry store analogy, that when there are problems there, then they're come to rely on this money, and now the companies don't have it.
Exactly. When I teach some of this information, people are often surprised when I say all of these companies make so much money, whether it's a bank or a credit card company, they make so much money on these interest charges that it becomes a business unto itself. It becomes a business of exploitation.
We have another question for you from a listener.
Hi, my name is Wendy. I'm calling from Asheville, North Carolina. I'm in debt really badly from a student loan. I will be paying about double, a little over double what I borrowed. I'll be 69 years old when this loan gets paid off.
So what do you say to her?
Call up the lenders and try to negotiate some better terms. Or maybe, and I think this was the case when I was in school, there were certain jobs you could take that might write down part of the loans, like teaching in an underprivileged area. I remember part of my loans were written off because I worked in a school in an underprivileged area, and they wrote down like 10% or 15% of my loan. They should ask if there are any relief programs that are available to her, because that is horrific.
So people need to remember that they can be more assertive. Alvin Hall, where it's always a great pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alvin Hall, financial educator and author of You and Your Money, Mastering the Emotions Behind the Numbers.
And more advice from all of you, and as part of our week-long series on debt in America.
My debt was paid down by not using my credit cards anymore and paying only cash for everything.
Despite the fact that we have two incomes, we have bought a house based on one income, which pays off since we've both been laid off since we've been married.
My wife is a genius CFO of this family, and we never carry a balance on any of our credit cards.
It's really important that we teach our children about credit card debt. Now at 26, as a teacher, I'm putting all of my paychecks toward paying off my high-interest credit cards instead of putting money into my savings.
Our entire debt series is on our website at takeaway.org. And also Alvin Hall, who you just heard, is going to be answering more of your questions about getting out of debt later today. You can send your questions now on our website and return at 1 p.m. Eastern for a live Q&A. It's 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And your takeaway?
They don't have the best interests of the country or their workers at heart. And unless we do something about this, there's going to be a total collapse. The collapse now is here.
20 years ago, he started trashing the auto industry. He's still doing it. It's Michael Moore talking about the auto industry and their predicament. We are always on at The Takeaway. You can also take us to go every morning with our daily podcast. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. You know, that Michael Moore, he's got that Michigan voice, man, that I remember from my high school days.
He does, but he certainly was on the money when it came to predicting what was going to happen to the auto industry.
Or no money, as the case may be. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji. It's Friday, and it's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Astrophysics has the blues.
Yes, I'm here in the dark. And I'm feeling so very blue.
Hey, folks, most of the universe is in the dark somewhere. The problem is finding it. If scientists even found their mysterious dark matter, would they be able to recognize it? Dancing in the Dark. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, November 21st. Nice song. Who was singing, John?
It's Taj Mahal.
Lovely way to start the Friday morning that it is. Today, we're going to have a warning about Chinese cyber spies. We also have America's briefing book for President-elect Obama on education and freshman orientation for new lawmakers on Capitol Hill. It includes help on finding a place to live. That and more. First, these headlines.
Stocks have regained significant ground in Asia today. Wall Street appears headed for a higher open. That's after another extremely gloomy showing on Wall Street. The Dow lost 5.5% yesterday to close at 75.52. The S&P fell to an 11-year low. It lost 6.7%, begins trading this morning at 752.
This morning, President Bush signed a bill to extend unemployment benefits. It adds 13 more weeks in payments for states hardest hit by job losses. Unemployment is at a 16-year high.
And, of course, Congress heads off for a two-week Thanksgiving break today with all that news. And for now, lawmakers say they're still not ready to hand $25 billion over to Detroit's big three automakers. Ohio Senator George Voinovich is still lobbying for some sort of compromise, though.
If we don't get this done, and they do go under, I believe that we're going to have a deep recession, and quite frankly, from what I can pick up, we may just go over the cliff.
The cliffhanger continues till December 8th when Congress takes it up again.
Change is taking place on Capitol Hill. Several Senate fixtures are saying goodbye. Yesterday was Ted Stevens' turn. Also out are Virginia's John Warner, who served for nearly 30 years, and New Mexico's Pete Domenici, who's been at it 35 years. Warner and Domenici decided not to run for reelection. And a shakeup in a key House committee. California Democrat Henry Waxman will take over as head of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. He replaces Michigan's John Dingell, who's had the position for 28 years.
Seniority is important, but it should not be a grant of property rights to be chairman for three decades or more. It ought to be an important consideration, but not the sole consideration in taking leadership positions.
54 congressional newbies were attending freshman orientation this week, and by tradition, there was a lottery for who gets what office, where. Here's Alabama Democrat Bobby Bright on the luck of the draw.
I'm not choosy. I'm not an elitist. I got here because I'm a populist. I believe in the people, and so I don't need to have a plush, big plush office to represent my constituents.
A couple other stories. Attorney General Michael Mukasey collapsed last night in the middle of a speech, but no word on the cause. He spent the night in the hospital, but seems to be alert and talking. And a federal judge has ruled that the U.S. government has to release five more Gitmo detainees. We're talking about debt all week, and we want to hear your advice and stories about debt management this series. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Great stories from you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
It is essential that we see some restructuring, some path to viability from the industry.
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi from California speaking about the auto industry at a news conference on Capitol Hill yesterday. And earlier this week, I joked that Congress was asking the big three automakers who came to Washington looking for a bailout to bring them the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West before they do anything to help them out of their financial predicament. But it looks like that's exactly what the House and Senate did. Nancy Pelosi said in elaborating on her comments, if they show us the plan, until they show us the plan, we cannot show them the money. She and Senate Leader Harry Reid say if the domestic auto giants produce some viability plan first, Congress may act on a $25 billion aid package next month. David Herzenhorn has been covering this whole thing for the New York Times. And David, from Washington, D.C., thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
So they got a definite maybe yesterday. Is that your read?
Or a less than definite maybe.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. The appetite in Congress for a big aid package for the auto industry is not that huge. There's a lot of concern about what would happen if one of these companies collapse, but there's also a lot of distaste for the idea of another big corporate, you know, financial lifeline. And at this point, the automakers just haven't done themselves any favors. And amazingly, the thing that everybody has focused in on is the fact that these CEOs came to Washington flying on expensive private corporate jets, which, of course, CEOs do all the time. But the symbolism of that, at a time when they're asking for billions in taxpayer dollars to keep their companies afloat, just had everybody on Capitol Hill shaking their heads.
Well, I don't know what sort of historical traction you have here. Is this a question of bad timing on the part of the automakers, that it would have been better if they'd come here maybe 6 months ago before Lehman had failed and tried to do this? Or is there some sort of policy difference between the predicament of the auto industry and what happened to Chrysler back in the 1980s, or Penn Central, or Lockheed, or any of the other corporations that Washington has bailed out down through the years?
Well, there's no question there's some bad timing here, but how do you focus on which part of it? I mean, for a bailout, certainly it would have been better to come before the financial system was collapsing, before the $700 billion bailout made bailout, you know, a four-letter word. Now you have to ask, though, is did the automakers, you know, have bad timing when they fought higher fuel efficiency standards for decades and decades?
Right.
Trent Lott, the former Republican majority leader, was telling me that he was amazed when last year's energy bill was getting debated, that the automakers didn't think there were going to be higher fuel efficiency standards. He said, I guess they thought they could fight it and beat it back, and instead they were caught by surprise when it was actually approved. So there's no question there's bad timing, but it may be bad timing by years or decades, not by months. The other bad timing is that trying to get something like this done in a lame duck, you know, a post-election session of Congress, is just hard and probably was a bad idea, given that Barack Obama has expressed support for helping the auto industry. If they could have figured out a way to wait until he was inaugurated, it would have been a lot easier going than it has been. There's
well,
no question about
and
that.
Maybe the plan is this idea of converting $25 billion in money already earmarked for fuel efficiency and for new technology going into just the basic financial books of the automakers to keep them afloat until Barack Obama gets into office is that bridge that you're talking about. David Herzenhorn from The New York Times, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure thing.
Talking about the definite maybe, or the less than definite maybe, from Congress for the automakers on the bailout plan.
We're going to head into cyberspace and cyber spies. According to a new report by the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, China is aggressively developing its power to wage cyber warfare by hacking computer systems of the U.S. government, defense companies, and businesses. It predicts the infiltration could disrupt American military and defense activities around the world. Joining us to talk more about this is Larry Wurzel, chairman of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. Good morning and welcome, Larry.
Good morning, Adora. Thanks for calling.
So let's forget the trench coats and dark alleys, spies sneaking around online. What information was the report based on?
Time magazine did sort of an expose of this in 2005, but we've also, because of our congressional mandate, interviewed defense officials in the intelligence agency, and people from out of the computer security corporate community.
And what do you believe the Chinese government is stealing, and how do you know it's actually them?
Attribution is very difficult. The original attribution on this approach was in 2003 by an employee of Sandia National Labs, who was a network system manager and saw strange activity on his network. And he claims to have actually tracked it back to a server in Canton, China, and notified Army intelligence and the FBI. And then he became disgruntled and was unhappy with what he thought the progress should be, and finally revealed it to Time in 2005. But since then, that set of intrusions was called Titan Rain by the U.S. government, and they've been more forthcoming about it. The director of Central Intelligence Agency has testified in front of Congress about these things. The director of the FBI has testified in front of Congress about these things.
So what kind of things are being stolen?
Well, it's Army manuals or military manuals on how we intend to conduct operations. It's logistics data and how we support operations. It's technical data on how we produce defense systems or the capabilities of defense systems. The amount of data, at least the head of the Air Force Warfighting Integration Center estimated it as twice the amount of the Library of Congress. 20 terabytes of information has been extracted.
Wow.
I'm wondering, Larry, though, is this a matter where the United States has exhibited a certain level of complacency, assuming a level of technological superiority that put encryption off the front burner? Or is China aggressively pursuing our technology in a kind of an arms race, match for match, our security measures, their countermeasures, and we're seeing the Chinese winning here?
Well, it's a classical espionage activity. China's more active at it than any other country, according to the FBI. It goes along with traditional espionage and economic espionage, and the Justice Department has had, I think, 8 or 10 convictions just this year for espionage emanating out of China. So they have a centrally directed plan, actually since 1986, to bring in technology that improves their national defense and their military, and at the same time improves their economy. And they're doing well at it.
And the Soviets had a similar program, but they were using more conventional methods. The Chinese have just sort of greased the skids with this digital component.
Well, I'm very familiar with that Russian program. Our Soviet program. We worked well, our intelligence services, with the French on that, if you recall the history of it.
Sure.
But we didn't have an internet then. So what at one time was eavesdropping, electronic penetrations, monitoring of satellite communication or telephone conversations and traditional espionage has now turned into computer hacking.
Which you can be done from the comfort of your own home, I guess.
Anywhere, yeah.
Well, I assume that your report was essentially putting the entire government on notice. Clearly they're aware of this. And what are they doing to combat it?
Well, we raised it first a couple of years ago. There have been interagency task forces in the intelligence community put together, both to detect these penetrations and to counter them. One of the things we're recommending, we're doing a classified report, but an unclassified recommendation of the classified report will be an improved education program out of our counterintelligence community for businesses and the public. But it's just a continuous effort by counterintelligence agencies to protect against these intrusions.
Larry Wurtzel, we appreciate your time this morning.
Well, thanks for having me on your show.
Larry Wurtzel is the chairman of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. So, spies in cyberspace, John.
Yeah, you can do it from the comfort of your own home. It's
they can all
very
do
convenient.
It. Nobody has to leave anymore.
A lot of people changing careers right now.
Just tap in.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. This week has been Debt Week at The Takeaway. We've been asking your advice about how to get out of debt. We've been asking you your story about how you're handling debt.
My wife and I are depression babies in our 70s. Our mantra was, don't buy it if you can't afford it. So, and we have no debt, and that's the reason why we're not so bad off today as a lot of people.
Thank you very much, and we want to hear how you're coping. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Now we're going to add a couple more pages to America's briefing book for Barack Obama, and the issue of education is what's up this morning. It's actually quite interesting for the new president who takes office in January because there was a lot changed by the Bush administration in education policy over the last two terms. It may be hard to remember. Most of it took place before 9/11, but education policy changed significantly under Bush's No Child Left Behind Act and other programs which brought so-called accountability to the educational forum. What will happen for Barack Obama, and what are the agenda items that are most important for him to deal with based on campaign statements and the educational priorities around the nation? So we asked Carmita Vaughn, who's the chief of staff of high schools in the Chicago public school system, who's close there in Chicago to ground zero for Barack Obama. Carmita, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John. Good morning.
You know, it's fascinating to talk to you because, you know, No Child Left Behind before 9/11 was a real success, or at least a legislative success, perceived success of the Bush administration in bringing accountability to what were perceived as failing public schools around the country. What do you think Barack Obama should do day one on education policy? Extend on No Child Left Behind, roll it back, or something in the middle?
You know, I'd say it's something in the middle. I think you have to start by acknowledging the fact that increased accountability is exactly what our system needs, but increased accountability without any funding is not going to bring the education system the transformational change that it needs to actually transform. I think you heard Obama talk a lot about this during the campaign, but what you want to do now is get really specific and talk about what does increasing funding mean? What does that increase in funding actually go towards, and how do you use that to address what I think are some crippling issues, such as the dropout crisis that's happening in this country, the lack of support and preparation for our teachers, and so on and so forth.
Well, the funding priorities are on a collision course with the revenue predictions on states and localities. I mean, the federal government is perceived to have only about a 14% financial stake in the national school systems around the country. What can the federal government do to increase that revenue to compensate for states and localities that are looking at declining tax revenues as a beginning here?
You know, I think, and I'm going to start by saying, I think it's not just about the dollars. I think clearly, you know, funding No Child Left Behind has to be a priority. But I think that there's a lot of other things that can happen at a federal level that aren't just about increasing funding. But as an example, you know, you've got this change platform. I think you can build on that by recognizing there's lots of very strong innovations that are going on across this country. And you've got these pockets of excellence and schools and districts that are doing phenomenal things. I think as a step one, you could, at the federal level, really start to look at what are those pockets of innovations that are working? How do you actually spread those best practices across the country? How do you pull together a clearinghouse of what's working and provide that information to states and districts that are struggling, as an example? In a situation where you're fiscally constrained, you have to start getting innovative and thinking about what do you do when, you know, potentially additional dollars aren't going to come.
So a basic improved level of support for schools that are in financially strapped states and localities, a separate policy-based funding of innovations that may have actually emerged during the previous 8 years of the Bush administration, and then expanding on the infrastructure at the federal level to be a clearinghouse for educational success stories and best practices that may be sort of hidden in states and localities around the country. Is that sort of a broad sketch takeaway at this point?
At this point, I mean, and I'll be honest, I know a lot about a lot of issues, but I'm not an expert at this. But if I were sitting down and having a conversation with folks in the Obama administration, I think that that's a starting point.
So have you had those conversations?
I have not.
You have not had those conversations. So no. think way out on the fringe in terms of, say, 8 years from now, if a lot of the initial successes actually happen for you, what would be a kind of pie-in-the-sky program that you would love to see initiated as a real big idea in this administration?
Oh, John, you're allowing me to think big. I like that. For me, there's a couple of hallmark issues that I think this administration should really tackle. And I think it'd be quite a success story in 8 years if you could say that you saw substantial movement on these two or three things. One, as I mentioned earlier, be it the dropout crisis. When I was on the show about 2 or 3 weeks ago, we laid out the national numbers, the fact that, 50% in our urban centers, around 50% of our students are not graduating high school. If there could be some substantial improvements in
Great.
That dropout rate.
So reduce dropouts, that's number one.
Reduce
dropouts. We're going to get to the other two quickly.
The other two, one being a focus on college readiness and changing the conversation from K-12 to K-16.
All right, upgrade college readiness.
Absolutely. And then a final one would be early childhood. And ensuring that our students are starting school with the preparation they need to be successful.
Well, that's quite an agenda, a lot on the table there. Carmita Vaughn, if you can't have conversations with the Obama administration, we'll make sure this information gets to them. Right? People listen to our program. Carmita Vaughn,
Chief. If you have that kind of pull, I appreciate it, John.
Memo from Carmita Vaughn, Chief of Staff for High Schools for Chicago Public Schools, speaking to us about education policy for the new president from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. And now Mark Garrison has some headlines.
Thank you. 28 minutes after the hour, Dow futures are up about 2.5% with just moments to go before Wall Street opens. A federal judge ordered the release yesterday of five Algerian men held at Guantanamo Bay. The judge said there isn't enough evidence to keep them. The men were among a group of inmates who won a Supreme Court ruling that they had the right to seek release in federal court. They'd been held for almost 7 years. Attorney General Michael Mukasey collapsed while giving a speech in Washington last night. The Justice Department said the 67-year-old cabinet member was conscious and alert after being admitted to George Washington University Hospital. President Bush spoke to him this morning. The White House said he sounded well. Three are dead after a suicide bomber drove his car into the gate of an army base in southern Afghanistan earlier today. In a separate incident, Afghan and coalition forces killed four militants in fighting north of Kabul. People on unemployment can expect to receive checks for an additional 7 weeks. President Bush signed a bill this morning to extend benefits. Job hunters in the hardest hit states can get benefits for even longer.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Congress was in session this week, making big headlines on issues confronting the country, like the financial bailout plan and the auto industry proposed bailout plan. But what you might not know is behind the scenes, another exercise nearly as important was taking place. That was freshman orientation week. 54 new lawmakers were readying themselves for office come January.
Well, hi, I'm from Missouri. How are you? What's your major?
Is that how it goes?
I think it may be something along those lines, kind of like a seminar. But yeah, they are going to be majoring in certain things. And this week it was all about finding a place to live and essentially learning how to vote. Right. Todd Zwillick, who's joining us now. He's PRI's Capital News Connection and our friend at The Takeaway. Good morning, Todd.
Hi. Good morning.
Where do they start? How do you learn to become a lawmaker?
This is Congress school. They go to classes all week. You know, freshman orientation in Congress is really a lot like freshman orientation at college. They have mixers. They have meet and greets. They have seminars. They learn everything, like you said, from learning how to get an apartment to hiring a chief of staff and a staff, how to get an office set up. Everything from that to learning actually how to vote, how to stick their electronic card in the slot and press yay, nay, or present. They have a class on that, too. They learn the rules of the House. They learn about seniority. They learn probably a little bit of how not to mess up, and they go to school for the week.
Well, they got a good lesson on seniority this week, didn't they, with the big battle between Dingell from Michigan and Waxman from California.
Yeah, they did. It's not all fun and games this week. There actually is quite a lot of politics, and it can be extremely daunting for some new members. When they come to town, leadership elections always take place during orientation, and the incoming freshmen, even though they've never cast a vote on the floor, they have to vote, and that means the lobbying from the senior members starts right away. There were members who won election to Congress for the first time on Tuesday night, November 4th, and Wednesday morning got a call from Henry Waxman. And from John Dingell, two guys, some of them, they weren't really sure who they were, but they found out pretty quick because these were two, as we said earlier this week, these were two titans running for control of a major committee. And the pressure is on now. It's a secret ballot. They don't have to say how they're going to vote, but the pressure's on for their votes, and they get calls and they get lobbied by lots of senior members.
Kind of like Fraternity Rush, I guess.
Except for it's the opposite there, right? The senior members tend to be harder on the junior members, as opposed to the senior members lobbying the junior members.
Yeah, it's a form of hazing, I guess.
And Todd, obviously nothing is more important than where they are going to put down their belongings and have their offices. Let's listen. You spoke to Bobby Bright, an incoming Democratic freshman from Alabama, and here's what he said about his office.
I'm not choosy. I'm not an elitist. I got here because I'm a populist. I believe in the people, and so I don't need to have a plush, big plush office to represent my constituents.
Put him in the parking lot then.
Yeah, well, Bobby Bright doesn't have to worry about being given a big plush office. There's almost no chance of that. There is a strict pecking order in Congress, and what happens is all of the other senior members get to choose their offices according to the strict seniority, and the 54 new freshmen get the dregs. They get whatever's left. So the way it works is an office lottery, and that's today. And it is a lottery. All 54 names, there are 54 incoming freshmen, and this morning they're going to gather in a big room in the Rayburn Building. They're going to put all their names in a bingo-style lottery hopper. It's a wire hopper. Choose their names. Getting number 54 is bad. Getting number 1 is great. That means you choose first. And listen to this. Here was the scene 2 years ago at the office lottery. It can get emotional.
Ms. Gabriel Giffords. 47. Ms. Gillibrand. Ms. Gillibrand selected number 3.
Uh-oh.
Right?
Any running water there for Ms. Giffords?
Well, people might be curious who – it's been in the movies and stuff, in Eddie Murphy movies, who has the worst office in all of Congress. And there probably is no single worst office, but Gabrielle Giffords, who's from Arizona, by the way, probably has one of the worst. She is – when she got 47 2 years ago, that means that she got parked up there on the 5th floor of the Cannon Building. Now, that doesn't sound so bad. You are a member of Congress, but most of the elevators in Cannon only go to 4. And Gabby Giffords herself calls that office nosebleed heaven. And she told me the other day that often when constituents come to visit her in the Cannon building, they can't find their way there because the elevator doesn't go all the way to her office. They have to send staff down to the lobby to collect the constituents to get them up to the office. So she calls it nosebleed heaven, but she did say one thing. She told me that, you know, she gets a lot of exercise walking back and forth to the floor and to the committee room. However, she found out that nosebleed heaven belonged to Lyndon Johnson when he was a freshman.
Huh.
So she doesn't feel too badly about it, that she might be going places.
He did okay.
Yeah,
he did all right.
He did okay. But once you've gotten an office, do you have to stay in that office or can you get an upgrade?
Oh, upgrades happen almost immediately, and people get them almost immediately. It's all about seniority. So once you're no longer a freshman, once members retire or lose elections, what happens is everybody below them in seniority gets to move up the chain. So if an 18 member retires or passes away or leaves Congress for some reason, a 17 term member could choose to move into that office, and then everybody else can move up. And earlier this week, the more senior members are choosing offices based on seniority. Whatever is left vacant from that, the freshmen get to choose from the dregs there.
Just out of curiosity, not to put you on the spot, but let's take Senator Ted Stevens' office, for example. I mean, he has been in the Senate for 40 years. I'm assuming he's got a great office. Who gets it?
Well, who will get it? Well, the Senate works a little bit differently than the House, actually, of course, but it is also based on seniority, and whoever gets Ted Stevens' office will be the most senior member who wants to move. So they'll go to the next senior member, and it would be somebody. God, it might even be Ted Kennedy. You can't imagine Ted Kennedy wanting to move. He's got a fantastic office. However, they would go to Senator Kennedy and say, the office is available. Senator, do you want to move? And he would say, gee, do I want to move my staff of 220 people? However, more than Stevens' office, he has what's called a hideaway. Very senior senators have little nooks inside the Capitol itself. These offices are not in the Capitol. They're in the office buildings. But senior senators have nooks, and they're ornate little – they're called hideaways. That's where senators can go.
They're even called cabins. Cabins.
Yep.
So Ted Stevens would call them. Todd Zwillick, reporter for PRI's Capitol News Connection. Thanks, bud.
Oh, no. For all you need to know, go, go, Todd Zwillick.
And now, headlines from Mark Garrison.
Indeed. Coming up on 20 minutes before the hour, Wall Street is now open for business. The Dow is up about 2% at the moment. Good news after yesterday's big drops. This follows a strong day in Asian markets. European markets have been mixed. Leaders of the big three automakers spent 2 days this week hitting Congress up for money, but Democratic leaders say they want to know how automakers will rebuild their industry. Congress may return in December for a vote if the companies give them a plan on how they would restructure their business. The May earthquake in China's Sichuan province left more than 88,000 people dead or missing. Today, China announced that more than 19,000 of them were schoolchildren, much higher than previous estimates. Ugh, many poorly built schools were responsible during the 7.9 quake.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry. In a week of thinking about debt and the sinking economy, I think it's safe to say that we're all looking for a little leadership in this time of confusion.
I'll be 69 years old when this loan gets paid off. I'm about $60,000 in student loan debt.
As the months passed, we kind of got behind in a lot of our bills.
And the next thing you know, you're just paying enough to cover the interest, and it never goes away.
It's been the first time the American economy has faced challenges, and it's not going to be the first time that we haven't recovered and come out better either.
In listening to our leaders, sometimes hope feels like a rather thin beverage, you know, even from someone who embodies millions of people's hopes for the future.
I'm going to confront this economic crisis head on by taking all necessary steps to ease the credit crisis, help hardworking families, and restore growth and prosperity.
So in the midst of pain, where does that confidence come from? Is it in the big voices?
All of us are used to spending money for things that we want. Things, however, which are not absolutely essential. We will all have to forego that kind of spending.
Or is it in the smaller voices?
Ray from Northbridge. With so much pressure from advertisement and everybody else, everybody wants to have the nicest things and stuff.
Don't live above your means. Simple and plain. Don't put things on credit if you can't afford it. That's it.
Presidents, of course, have their bully pulpit for lecturing us all about changing behavior. Sometimes, though, it's a stronger message when we hear it from someone we can relate to.
I am from Shrewsbury. The motto should be, do what you can with what you've got, what you know you've got.
Presidents like to talk about big ideas and taking big steps, but wisdom from the household can actually trump wisdom from the White House.
You and I, as individuals, can, by borrowing, live beyond our means, but for only a limited period of time. Why then should we think that collectively, as a nation, we're not bound by that same limitation?
Our debt problem in this country is our problem. It's Americans' problem. We can't blame the banks or the lending institutions for making cheap debt available to us. We don't have to take it. My name is Sean from Bradley Beach, and I want to tell you that I think that the greatest economist to ever live, who knew all about this stuff, was my mom. Said always save for a rainy day.
You know, in the end, the voices of all of you stack up pretty darn well to the more traditional voices of history.
Let us unite in banishing fear. We have provided the machinery to restore our financial system, and it is up to you to support and make it work.
Nothing's gonna harm you, not while I'm around. Nothing's gonna harm you, no sir, not while I'm around.
Thanks to all of you who helped with our debt series this week, calling us with your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We can do this.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, November 21st, and we're going to get caught up on the headlines this morning from Mark Garrison, who's sitting in for Femi Oke.
Thank you. We're coming up on 12 minutes before the hour. A spokeswoman for Attorney General Michael Mukasey says he's doing well and there's no indication he had a stroke. Mukasey collapsed in the middle of a speech yesterday evening. He spent the night at a D.C. hospital. Among his well-wishers, President Bush called him earlier this morning. The Dow is up around 1% at the moment. That is a shift from the brutal day in American markets yesterday. Hundreds of thousands of people whose unemployment benefits have run out or are about to run out are getting a break. President Bush has signed a bill to extend unemployment benefits. Many Americans are still not getting HIV testing. Researchers say only about 5% of patients with evidence of serious illness are being routinely tested in emergency rooms. That's despite recommendations that all people aged 13 to 64 be regularly tested. And that is your news.
Thank you, Mark. And I don't know if you've heard of this, Mark, but the universe does not add up. It's not really a news story. For decades, scientists have understood that there is something else out there. More matter than we can see. Adora loves a mystery. At least 25% of the universe is composed of something called dark matter. And finding the dark matter would solve one of the biggest cosmological mysteries of our time. Joining us now to talk about it is Brian Green, professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia University, author and our favorite cosmologist here at The Takeaway. Dr. Green, are we on the verge of discovering dark matter, and would we know it when we see it?
It's a real possibility. There's some interesting new data that is just coming to light. It could well point toward the discovery of dark matter, but it's very tentative. great discoveries require fantastically convincing evidence. This may be the first step in that direction.
Well, describe the experiments that are getting us close.
Well, there's one in particular. It's a balloon-borne experiment floating over Antarctica, and it is taking data from the heavens, from the sky, and they're seeing too many of a certain kind of particle called electrons. Too many, and they have to explain the source. And the source could be dark matter particles floating out there in space, colliding with one another, annihilating in a little burst that gives rise to these particles that they're seeing in the balloon. That's one possible explanation.
Why is the balloon in Antarctica again?
Well, we want you want away from civilization. You want it above the atmosphere. You want to eliminate all other sources of contamination. That's a very good place to do that.
Okay. Let's go to the beginning here. What is dark matter? Why do you call it dark matter? And if you can't see it, how do you know it's out there?
Well, that's a great series of questions. And the answer is basically this. When we, as John was saying, look out into the sky with very powerful telescopes, we see the visible matter, stars and galaxies moving. And the visible stuff is moving so quickly that it should all fly apart, much like water. If you picture water on a bicycle wheel as it's spinning, the water flies off if the wheel spins too fast. That should be happening to the stars and galaxies, but it's not. Therefore, there must be something exerting more gravity than the stuff we can see. Stuff that exerts gravity but doesn't give off light, therefore it's dark. Dark matter. And when you calculate how much should be out there, as John was saying, it should be about 25% of the mass of the universe.
Is there any other conceivable explanation for why the universe sticks together other than gravity from stuff we can't see?
Yes. When you come to mysteries, people always come up with alternate explanations. Maybe gravity doesn't behave the way we think it does. Maybe out there in space it has slightly different strength or different properties. People have put forward these explanations. None of them, though, are anywhere near as convincing as the elegance and the power of this notion of dark matter.
Well, hey, yeah, right. Stuff you can't see that solves the whole problem. Yeah, I love that kind of thing. Now, there's not only dark matter, there's dark energy. What's that?
Dark energy is another dark species. Again, it's dark, doesn't give off light. This is energy that would suffuse space in a very uniform way, not little particles that are out there floating. And we've come to the recognition that there should be dark energy by studying how fast the universe is expanding. Mm-hmm. We have found...
How fast is that?
Well, it's faster than we thought. And we had thought previously that the universe is expanding. We learned that back in the 1920s. But we thought it'd be slowing down in its expansion, like when you throw a ball up in the air, it goes up slower and slower because ordinary gravity pulls it back. When we have now measured the rate of expansion, it's not slowing down like that ball. It's speeding up. It's going faster and faster. It's like you throw the ball up in the air and it goes up faster and faster. If that were to happen, you'd know there must be something pushing out, not just gravity pulling in. There must be an anti-gravity out there. And this dark energy, according to Einstein himself, can give rise to this anti-gravity.
Well, let's go back to the Antarctic experiment for a moment. I mean, what could be really startling about this is that the count of electrons, the oversupply of electrons that would normally be predicted, gives you the suspicion that dark matter must be producing the electrons. How could that be happening again?
Well,
what's
happens
that connection?
So you have the dark matter particles floating out there,
right?
And every so often they bang into one another.
Okay.
When they find each other, they annihilate. And when they annihilate, the end product can be these little electrons.
And dark matter, then, is atoms and particles like we know of. It's just that they have such low energy that we can't really see them or
almost
detect them.
The one thing I would stress is we've learned that the dark matter can't be made of the stuff we're made of. It can't be made of protons, neutrons, and electrons.
I see.
That runs afoul of other observations and other understandings of how the universe evolved.
So it's got to be quarks.
No, even more exotic. Really? Even more exotic than that. So any particle that you've probably heard of, it can't actually be the dark matter. That's why it's so exciting. We're trying to put our finger on a new species of particle that probably makes up at least 25% of the universe.
But how do you invest that? What kind of tools that do you use in looking for something that you've never seen before?
Well, that's a challenge. And that's why these experimenters get paid a lot of big bucks. You know, they come up with these very refined observational tools, put them either on a rocket or on a balloon, and observe particles that slam into these detectors. And based upon how the particle excites the detector, you can figure out how much the particle weighs, whether it has electric charge, whether it doesn't, and its other properties.
What are you going to do with all those big bucks that they gave you to do the experiment? All right, now watch this, Adara, okay? All right, watch this. Okay, Dr. Green, if the experiment confirms the existence of dark matter and we observe it, complete this sentence. Now that we've found the dark matter in the universe, we know blank.
We know what the universe is largely made of. I mean, a question that the Greeks asked 2,500 years ago is, what is stuff made of? We've been struggling with that question ever since. We've come to the strange conclusion that the stuff we know about, chairs and table and people and stars, is made up of different material than the bulk of what's out there. We want to figure out what the bulk is made of.
He's pretty good.
I know. He's excellent. Yeah. It's riveting.
Is it the end of physics, though? Is it one of those like unified field theory things where Einstein was trying to unite all of the forces and sort of end the matter of physics? Or is it going to open more doors?
It'll clearly open more doors, because once we know what's out there, we can try to produce it perhaps in the laboratory, study it under idealized conditions. And this will then back react on our theories, like the unified theories that we're searching for, allowing us to refine them, eliminate some possibilities perhaps. So it's a real exciting prospect. But let me just emphasize, we don't know that this is the discovery of dark matter. It could be something more prosaic, maybe a pulsar that's giving off these electrons. So
boring old pulsars, I know. I just hate that.
But there are actually a confluence experiments, the one in Antarctica. There's a satellite called PAMELA that's also seeing this excess of electrons. So it's coming from a variety of sources, so maybe it's real.
Mysterious excess electrons and dark matter. Brian Green, thanks so much for helping to explain the mystery. Brian Green is professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia University, our favorite cosmologist.
Philip Pullman comes to mind, the Dark series, right? The Golden Compass, the book, they made it into a movie. Anyhow, physics and dark matter and all of those things, fascinating.
There's no darker
also
matter than debt.
I was about to say, also fascinating. Thanks for that help with that segue, John. Appreciate it. Talking about debt, today is the last day of our week-long series on debt in America, and here are some of the voices we talked to all week.
You have a country that encourages a culture of debt. At a certain point, you put your head in the noose.
Americans are always right at the top in terms of optimism, and if you think tomorrow is going to be better than today, one of the things you don't do is save a lot of money.
You can't buy a toaster in the United States that has a 1 in 5 chance of exploding, but you can buy a credit card that can throw you into financial chaos.
I've just never really believed that debt was a good idea.
Pay the bill.
You pay the bill.
And I'm an old man. My parents were depression people, and I never learned to do it the other way.
You can see this week's entire debt series on our website, thetakeaway.org. And, of course, we will continue to keep talking about debt because it's something the country continues to struggle with. Today at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Alvin Hall, our financial consultant, will answer your questions about getting out of debt. Send them now and send them early. Send a few questions and return to our website for his live Q&A today at 1 p.m. Eastern.
So when we come into the office in the wee hours of the morning, we already have a jump on the day's news thanks to our colleague at our partner, the BBC. And we'd like to give a particular shout out to our man in London, Nick Sindel's last day is today. And if he were here in New York, there'd be some pubs that would be closing later than normal tonight. But we want to thank him for helping us out to get this show off the ground. And we'd like to welcome his replacement there at the Beeb, Andrew Bowman. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji. It's Friday. It's The Takeaway. And we wish you a good weekend.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.